This is a CBC podcast.
CBC podcasts are supported by HP Print Studio. Express your brand with HP Print Studio. Find free, customized templates to build your business identity, like letterhead, business cards, and shipping labels. Start the journey at www.hp.ca/print.
Hello, and welcome to the Vinyl Cafe podcast. We publish a new podcast every weekend. You can download the latest or subscribe to the Vinyl Cafe podcast at cbc.ca/podcasting. This week, the Vinyl Cafe heads north.
So I met Rennie Fumalo backstage back in Yellowknife before we headed for Inuvik. Someone said he was a man I should meet, a man I would enjoy talking to. Fumalo is 80 years old, small and compact and totally energetic. He was wearing a plaid shirt and soft shoes and had his hair pulled back in a ponytail the night I met him. He's a retired oblate father, but he looks more like an elf than a priest. I have to say I was feeling suspicious before we met, because there's no doubt in my mind there was terrible cultural damage done by the church to Aboriginal cultures. But there's no doubt there was enrichment, too. And it didn't take me long to recognize that Fumalo's contribution would certainly have been additive. He is a quiet, humble man. A poet, it turns out. Rennie Fumalo was born and raised in France. He came to Canada in 1953 as a missionary to work with the Dene people. Coming in 1953 means that Fumalo arrived in the north before telephones and televisions and radios and highways. And that means, for all intents and purposes, when he was living with the Dene people, he was living largely the way they had been living for thousands of years. And that means Rennie Fumalo is a time machine. I find this notion that there are people among us who can connect to the distant past compelling in a way that I don't fully understand. I just know that I'm both drawn to them and to the idea of them. It's very special. It's something that can't happen just anywhere anymore. It's not likely you'll meet a man like Rennie Fumalo in New York City or London. But if you're lucky, you might in a place like Yellowknife. We found a quiet corner of the theater, Rennie and I, a stairwell, actually, and we began to talk. Well, it really wasn't a conversation. It was more like an interview. I was full of questions. What did you eat? I wondered. He seemed so healthy and vigorous, I couldn't help wondering. Whatever we had, he said. Fish and caribou, seal and whale. And when did you eat? Whenever there was food, he said. And what about vegetables? Sometimes, he said, we had potatoes. But no greens. We ate the guts of the fish for vitamin C. I asked him what time they used to go to bed, especially in the winter when it was dark nearly all the time. He told me he didn't have a clue. We didn't have clocks, he said. And then I asked what they did at night before they went to bed. And he told me they loved games. Three men would sit facing three other men, and they'd each be holding a token, a little object of some kind, and they'd pass it back and forth from one hand to the other, trying to hide what they were doing, trying to confuse the men on the other side of the room. They'd sing while they did this. Fumalo crossed his arms and began jogging up and down and chanting, and then he said they would do that, and then they would stop, and they would hold their hands out in front of them, and the men on the other side of the room would have to guess which hand the object was in. He said they would play that game for hours. He told me about a sermon he had given once when he was a young priest, and how he'd realized years later that the tone and the message of his talk had been all wrong, and probably even insulting to the Dene. And that when he had asked someone about it years later, he asked why they hadn't corrected him, or at least said something. The man had smiled and explained that Rene was just a young man when he'd given that sermon. We trusted you'd work it out for yourself one day, said the man. They never told me how to do anything, said Rene. They let me make any mistake I wanted, and I made plenty. They believe that's how you learn things, by making your own mistakes. I want to read you one of his poems right now. It's just a short poem, and it's called Truck Lights. It's winter time and very cold, early afternoon and already dark. I'm driving from Yellowknife to Ray in my 15-year-old pickup truck, and a Dene elder asks me for a ride. The land has taught the Dene to live in a world of silence. After 10 kilometers, Colchia reflects. Driving the truck is like having faith in God. I'm trying to figure out what he means, but after 2 kilometers, I give up. Grandpa, I said, you talked about driving and faith in God. I'm not sure what you meant. Colchia turned slightly towards me. You started the engine, and you put the lights on. We could have said, we see only 100 meters ahead of us. Further on, it's 100 kilometers of darkness. So we cannot go to Ray. But you got the truck into gear, we started to move, and the lights kept showing ahead of us. Must be the way with God, too, who shows us only a bit into the future, just enough for our next move. If we're afraid, and if we stand still, we'll never see farther ahead. But if we go with the little light we have, the light keeps showing us the way, on and on. That was Truck Lights, and that's a poem by Reni Fumalo. It's in Reni Fumalo's book of poems called Here I Sit. So after a day in Inuvik, we flew up to Tuktoyaktuk. Flight shouldn't have taken more than about 40 minutes, maybe less, but we took the long way, almost an hour and a half. It was a small plane with maybe 10 of us aboard, and the pilots had things they wanted to show us. So they kept zigging and zagging, and I didn't realize what was going on at first and thought maybe they were having a hard time finding Tuk, which meant I wasn't enjoying the sights as much as I might have. We were flying low, under 1,000 feet for sure, and until I figured out we were on a sightseeing tour, I was on point, looking for a spot where we could ditch in case we ran out of gas, which I was pretty convinced we were going to do at any moment. All of this I know tells you more about me than I probably should be telling. Anyway, when I got over myself, I spent a lot of the flight watching the trees slowly disappear. Tuk is north of the tree line, which of course isn't a line at all, but just a gradual petering out until there's only the odd tree and then none at all. Just lakes and tundra. I kept hoping I'd spot the last tree and thought that might make a good kid's book. The story of a lonely little tree in the Arctic who gives shelter to a rabbit or a mouse or something before someone comes along and cuts it down or whatever. When we finally made it to the Northern Ocean, Tuk is on the coast where the Mackenzie River empties into the Beaufort Sea, we kept going. We headed out over the Beaufort Sea, and now, of course, I figured we were really doomed. Listen, the pilots kept turning around and saying, we're not sure, we've never done this before. And I kept saying, well, how long until we get there? And they'd say, oh, 10 minutes or so, and then 10 minutes or so would go by, and all I saw was ice and a gray horizon. But it turned out they just wanted to show us an abandoned oil rig, and we circled it and then back and over Ellis Island and a few weather stations and a musk oxen or three, and before you knew it, we were landing in Tuk, and I don't know what all the worry was about. So there we were, finally, above the tree line, and well and truly in the Arctic. And the first thing that Vinyl Cafe producer Jess Milton wanted to do when we got there was the last thing that I wanted to do, and that was to go for a dip in the Beaufort Sea. It seemed to me that like eating blood pudding and having major oral surgery, swimming in the Arctic Ocean is an experience I'd be happy to miss. Someone had told Jess, you get a certificate if you go for a swim, and she's an achiever if nothing else, so this certificate thing struck her as a good idea. Necessary idea, actually. And more amazingly, once we had walked to the end of a cold, gray, rocky spit in the north end of town and stood there watching the wind licking the tops off the gray waves, she didn't change her mind. Off came her jacket and sweater and scarf, and on went her bathing suit, and away she went. She ran into the ocean, and when the water was waist high, she dunked and swam a few strokes, and then she came out, and now she has a certificate that confirms her membership amongst an exclusive club of brave adventurers. I'm reading from it right now. It says she is one of this club who have traveled to the Arctic coast, and in a true act of bravery, and there's a couple of little boxes next. On hers, the took a swim option is ticked. On mine, they've ticked dipped your toe. I actually went all the way up to my knees. There are pictures to prove it. Not that standing there in the ocean with your pants rolled up with the water lapping at your calves looking like a pensioner on a British beach is something you would necessarily want to prove. There are two types of people in this chilly world. Those who run the length of the dock and launch themselves with abandon into the lake without even stopping to check the water temperature or the prevalence of water snakes. There are those people. And there are the people who climb down the ladder cautiously, thinking with each cautious step that the lake seems colder than it has in years, and wondering vaguely if maybe they really want to swim at all. Well, I'm one of the second, and I know, the water's always great once you get in, but I don't think even Jess would tell you that about the Beaufort Sea. So Tuktoyaktuk is an Inuvialuit community, which is the first thing I learned when we arrived, the Inuvialuit being the people of the Western Arctic, distinct from the Inuit of the East. Now, the Inuvialuit from the West and the Inuit from the East being the people that people used to call Eskimo, which it turns out is a derogatory name given to them by rival Indian bands, meaning raw meat eater, I think. Anyway, we were in Tuk for the day, and the highlight for me was the lunch I was served at the home of Maureen and James Pokiak. James, like many people in Tuk, still hunts, and much of what his family eats is still what they call country food, food from the land. For lunch, we ate caribou stew, jerked whale meat, smoked whitefish, and muktuk, which is whale blubber. The caribou stew tasted more or less how you'd imagine it to taste, gamey and delicious. The jerked whale meat was bite-sized and black, chewy and smoky. And the blubber, again cut into bite-sized pieces, had three different colored layers, all sort of yellowish like fancy jello. It sort of melted in your mouth, and I don't really remember what it tasted like, but I had more than one piece and I didn't have to, so it must have tasted good. It was all very good and quite filling. Maureen and James' daughter, Myrna, served us. Myrna goes to school in the South. She's a student at the University of Victoria, and she was home on summer holidays and said when she's in the South, she misses the country food. After lunch, Myrna took us to the community freezer, which is this remarkable cave dug into the permafrost. Remarkable because I was told it takes two men 2 days to dig a grave with a jackhammer these days. And the freezer cave is 30 feet down into the permafrost, and it would have been dug by hand. To get in, you climb down an ice-covered wood ladder into the darkness, like going down hand over hand into a sewer. And when you get down there in the cold darkness, there are 3 tunnels, and off each tunnel, 6 rooms, which each belong to one family. The Pokiak family room, the only one I was in, is about the size of a small bedroom, and there was part of a whale carcass in there, and a couple of seal, and a big pile of frozen fish. The craziest thing is that it turns out the Pokiak family are huge fans of this radio show, and it fills me full of big feelings today to think of them up there on the edge of Canada where there are no trees, and in the winter the blizzards are so fierce that sometimes you can't go outside for 3 days. And the only way you could even make it to your neighbor's house would be if you tied a rope between the 2 houses before the storm began. Because you'd have to follow the rope. Because you could barely see your hand in front of your face, the wind would be blowing the snow so hard. And if you went out without the rope, you'd get lost and die. It fills me full of big feelings to think of them listening today, and I wanted to give them a shout-out and say thanks for lunch. It makes me feel wonderful to know you're listening, and that we might have anything to say that might ring remotely true to you. Thanks for listening.
That's Stuart McLean, and that's from the Vinyl Cafe. Stuart McLean and the Vinyl Cafe will be heading out on tour this autumn. They'll be doing live Vinyl Cafe concerts in British Columbia, Ontario, Quebec, and the United States. They'll be making stops in Kelowna, Nanaimo, Duncan, Trail, Vernon, Prince George, Terrace, Kamloops, Abbotsford, Montreal, Kingston, Huntsville, North Bay, Sudbury, Chatham, Indianapolis, Indiana, Cleveland, Ohio, Mount Clemens, Michigan, and Seattle, Washington. You can log on to the Vinyl Cafe website for a complete list of shows. You can find the Vinyl Cafe on the web at vinylcafe.com.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.